South Africa's Soweto String Quartet with Wimowe. They called it Imbube, but in brackets they also had Wimowe, so we'll go with that. It's from their 1996 album, Renaissance. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and it is Free Your Mind Friday. This is where you get to unload. And you can discuss things that you think are important or worthy of further discussion and debate. And we invite any and all to our weekly, this is our weekly open forum. And what we try to get at in this particular exercise is that you should get used to presenting your views. Whether people agree or disagree, it's really not material to the fact that you have the opportunity to lay your case out on whatever the topic is, and we'll get to listen, and people will react. They may ask you questions, but in any event, this is time that's set aside for you. I believe this is one of the most important things that this medium can do, which is to create a community, and a community that is actively engaged in the issues of the day, exchanging information and ideas and opinions, and, you know, we get to listen in. But you should get used to the idea of occupying public space, public intellectual space. This is time set aside for you. So the way we do this is the number to call is 888-874-4888. And then once you call in, we hope that you have a strong opinion about something. And we go from there, see what people think. 888-874-4888. Lots of stuff happening this week, and my thing is to listen today. We are listening more than I'm talking, hopefully. Okay, do we have any calls in queue? Apparently, you guys are slow in calling in today. Usually by now, this whole field would be lit up. So I don't know what this means. It means that you're trying to figure out, should you be first or not? Rosedale from Rosedale, Queens. Jose, you're on the air.
As always, my personal therapist.
You'd be surprised. How are you? To know that it's quite the other way around.
Well, you know, the last time I spoke to you, I told you one of our former prime minister from Jamaica would be visiting us here in Queens, and in a town hall kind of fashion. And he was here as a guest of for one of Jamaica's major food distribution company. Probably the only one. No, the major. And also, they have collaborated with one of those money transfers company, because that's the way they've been going in Jamaica, where they get married to some other multinational corporation so they can monopolize and control of every aspect of commerce in the island. So they were here two Thursdays ago, and I happened to drop by. And I'm just trying to, as your cub reporter, I'm reporting back to you. Anyway, the meeting, it started off on a late footing, but I didn't expect otherwise. So the presenters, they made their plug for the product. It's really, these type of events are really to plug away at the products that these companies produce, and to to tell us of the great charitable and philanthropic work that they've been doing all over the place, you know, give a few scholarships here and there and so on and so forth. And so after they were through with that, then the former prime minister, he got up and he spoke at length for over 1 hour. He spoke. And then after that, he graced us peons. They told us it was going to be about 10 minutes of Q&A. So anyway, I was strategically located so that the second question came from me. So I said to the prime minister, former prime minister, I greeted him. You know, I said, greetings, former Prime Minister Golding, and welcome to the diaspora's home away from yard. I said, you have covered a few issues here today, but I noticed one you didn't touch on, and that was the issue of human rights. I said, you know, former Prime Minister, throughout this world, we as African people, we're under siege, constantly under siege, from the motherland to the United States, to the Caribbean, to Europe, wherever we are as a people, we're constantly under siege. And when we're not being massacred, we are being denied all kind of rights and so forth. And not just us, but other oppressed people. And one of the oppressed people I want to talk to you, I'm going to touch on real quick, is those in this area, this region they call Palestine. I said the Palestinian people are being slaughtered. They are being used as target practice right before our very eyes, and the world is standing by and doing nothing. I said this, the leader of this great world, the free world, is complicit in the whole thing, and they are watching the final solution coming down on this group of people, which takes me right into our native island, Jamaica. I said, this month we're in, this year, it heralded in the 8th anniversary of that horrendous massacre that took place in a village in Kingston called Tivoli Gardens. I said it was the worst monstrosity that took place there in Jamaica's modern history. And I said the sad part about it is that it was done by people with the blood of Africa coursing through their veins, on a group of people with the blood of Africa coursing through their veins. I said the government said that it was 73 people, or just 73 people that was slaughtered. Even though the people on the ground says it was more like 200 or 300 people that were slaughtered, and people are still looking for their loved ones. And no justice was meted out to these folks. And I said,
so
today.
So what was his response?
Well, the question now is what I'm going to ask him. I just made my statement, but I'm asking a question now. I said, I want you to make a case to us and all the justice-loving people of the world as to why you and your cabinet members and anyone else complicit in this massacre should not be charged with crimes against humanity and take before the International Criminal Court of Justice, tried and found guilty and sent up the river for a long sentence so it will act as a deterrent to those who think like you that they can abuse our race the way you all have done. And with that, I ended. And he got up and he said, well, you know, he was very arrogant. He said, well, there's a fellow in Jamaica by the name of Lloyd de Aguilar. You can go online and see the brother. He's the only one carrying the name, remembering that massacre and trying to keep it alive and fighting for justice for the people. He said, there's a fellow in Jamaica by the name of Lloyd de Aguilar. He tried it. He tried, and it didn't work out. Now, maybe you seem to be more articulate and more determined. So maybe you could try. Maybe you might succeed. And that was the end of his response.
It's funny that he should say that. I happen to know Lloyd D'Aguilar.
Yes.
He's a journalist, if it's the same Lloyd D'Aguilar.
The same Lloyd D'Aguilar. Same
so
Lloyd.
He kind of has a pretty good facility with the language. So what does this say to you, this visit in your interpretation, what does it, in the end, what does it mean?
Well, to me, he is being sanitized, and the blood of the people being washed off his hands and drip and from his lips. And he's being sanitized to make another comeback. He has been given a position by his party, the new Prime Minister Holness. He is now in charge of looking at CARICOM and deciding what is the relevance of CARICOM to Jamaica and things like that. So he has been given a plush job with a good salary and perks and so forth. And from there, he's been brought back into the fold of humanity. And from there, we'll see what happens. You might even take another shot at prime ministership. Who knows? So this, to me, and then the company that sponsored this whole thing, they are part and parcel of the whole deal. And he's been there plugging their brand, and so this is it's a situation where the system, this is how the system protects and looks after their own, and while marginalizing the lives of African people, because you seem to be poor and defenseless, and you have no one to defend and look after your interests.
Well, I haven't seen any official reports, quote unquote, of his visit, but I do expect that at some point we'll get something, and we'll see how your reporting compares to theirs. And
no, it's edited.
When
they come and they have these meetings, and we go, and the activists, those of us who are activists, when we confront them, everything that we say, the questions we ask and the statements we make is edited out. When you see what they present on their media and so forth, no mention is made of anyone asking them any pertinent question. It is edited out.
Oh, I know. But at least there, you do have on the record that you attended, mm-hmm. that you asked these questions, and you just relayed what the answers were. And you also conjectured as to what might be expected in the not too distant future, the fact that this might be an outing for the his next try at being prime minister. So thank you very much for getting us started today. Thanks so much.
You're welcome, Mike.
Jeff from New Jersey, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing? I'm glad to hear it. I got a solution for all these things. Go back to church. Take your community centers and name them the Fannie Lou Hamer Community House of God. Name every church Sharon Baptist Church House of God. Because you know what you can do in the House of God? You can do what Jesus did. You invite every politician that wants to get your vote to come and speak to you in the House of God. And you ask them questions like the gentleman just did in the House of God, because we are all God's children, correct? Right. So now what Jesus did was he walked in there and he saw all the money changers and he saw all those thieves in his father's house. And he made a whip and he went to work. And that's exactly what we have to do. When they come down there and they're not speaking the truth, they don't pass the smell test, make a whip and start whipping some behind. You know, your homegrown, your politician. You get the father who has 16 kids, and
so
you put him in charge of the whipping.
Just make sure that they come into the house of God for a good whipping.
And when it says, it just says, why did you do that? Because this is what Jesus would do. And I put my hand on the Bible, and I swear, so you know what? If his word is more holier than the law, then what I did was more holier than. And you know what? If once they do it, and listen, if you don't get anything else but a 30-day jail sentence, you will have satisfaction of the soul. But the other thing we must do, and I'm not kidding about that. The other thing we must do is that with the gentleman with this thing in Jamaica and them not reporting what you say, get a printing press, make dittos, make one-sheet copies of what you asked the question and what his response was, and you pass it out like a newspaper. And you will see that those newspapers will grow. We need to protect that number one thing right now is to protect our media and our voices in the media. And we need to get to ask those, you know, pertinent questions. So when you do have those journalists, those activists out there, there needs to be a recording on paper of what they said, what they asked, and the response was. But, you know, I like the whipping idea, though.
I gather that you do. Thanks, Jeff, for your call today and for participating with a whip. That's right. Harvey from Berkeley, you're on the air.
Hi, Utrice. How are you today?
Okay. How are you doing?
Pretty good. Well, our history is rife with man's inhumanity to man, and it seems that we have a tendency and have been conditioned to see each other as the other. America's trillion-dollar military-industrial complex is a reflection of our inability to see ourselves as one. And I believe now is the time for us to become aware of a greater reality before we destroy ourselves and Mother Earth. And I would like to ask your vast audience to get a pen or a pencil and a piece of paper and write down the four names that I'm going to give you. The first one is Dr. John Mack, J-O-H-N-M-A-C-K. The second is Barbara Lamb, B-A-R-B-A-R-A. And the second name is L-A-M-B, like Lamb, Barbara Lamb. The third one is Preston Denette, P-R-E-S-T-O-N, P-R-E-S-T-O-N, D-E-N-N-E-T-T, two N's, two T's, D-E-N-N-E-T-T. And the last one is Mary Rodwell, M-A-R-Y-R-O-D-W-E-L-L, R-O-D-W-E-L-L. And if you go to YouTube, you'll find many lectures and interviews by Dr. John Mack, Barbara Lamb, Preston Denette, and Mary Rodwell about the research and revelation that we're not alone in the universe. And hopefully their information will help us see past our small-minded fears of each other while ushering us into a bigger, a greater reality with the perspective that we're part of the unique life that's in the cosmos. And I believe it's time to grow up and get past these fears of each other because we are one in the universe. And again, you can listen to the archive of your show today on Progressive Radio Network to hear the names again. And much love, and thanks for letting me share this information with you. And I think you're fantastic, Utrice.
Well, I think we all are. I really do. We're all trying in our own way to put one foot in front of the other and keep moving. Thank you so much. I want to ask you, though.
Yes.
You seem to believe that there is other life other than what we think.
Absolutely.
What makes you believe that?
Well, because in my study over the years, I've followed the UFO phenomena over the years, and the government has also started to come out with their perspective on the life of the possibility of life in space. And also, I think that the universe is humming with life, that basically planets are islands of life, like oases in a desert of space, but also that space itself, I believe that we live between three oceans, the ocean of water, the ocean of air, and the ocean of space. All three oceans are occupied with life. And that we human beings, we sort of penetrate into the ocean of water and into the ocean of space. And they found that life actually is growing in space. They did some experiments where they put some microbial life on space vehicles, and it went into space and came back, and it lived. I think they also found life on some of the International Space Station on the outside. But life, you know, we have something called extremophiles. And these are forms of life that exist in extreme places where we think that life can't exist. They found life at the bottom of the ocean, living off of volcanic vents, where they thought no way could life live down there with no light and under such pressure. They drilled holes into the earth, and they found microbial life that sort of live off of rock. They create a kind of an acid that turns rock into nutrients. They found under the polar caps, they found fish that have the component of antifreeze in their blood and can live under the ice. And so I think that life works through matter, any matter. It doesn't matter. Life is tenacious, and that's really what the universe is. It's a living entity itself. I also believe that consciousness permeates life, and intelligence permeates life. And so the whole universe is alive, it's intelligent, and it's conscious. And if any of those elements weren't there, the whole universe would collapse in on itself. So I believe that life is, you know, there's so much, to think that there's just life on the little planet Earth when there's trillions and trillions of other planets is, I think, kind of naive. So I feel that a lot of possibility that life has got started before us, perhaps millions of years before us, and that they're visiting us. And one day, we're going to Mars, we're going to the moon soon, and we're going to become extraterrestrial. And one day, it'll be our turn. You know, if you ask anybody about God, they'll point, you know, where's heaven? They'll point up. If you ask where the God is, they'll point up into the sky. And I believe one day it'll be our turn to be the sky gods when we become galactic. And we'll come down on some naive planets, and we'll be considered the sky gods with our high technology. And it'll be our turn to be the ones that are prayed to. So I think that all signs prove that the universe is humming with life. And I believe that people like Dr. John Mack, Dr. Barbara Lamb, Preston Dennett, and Mary Rodwell will further inform us as to this reality.
Thank you for calling and contributing.
My pleasure.
Lee from New York. You're joining us today. Thank you.
Yes, hi, Yatrice. It's a real honor to speak with you. I'm a longtime listener, and this is the first time I've called. I consider you the foremost news analyst and political strategist in the country, and I really appreciate
you. Did I fool you?
I really appreciate your erudition and insight, and particularly the clarity of your thought and speech. So I feel it's a bit daunting to speak with you, and especially in front of your incredible audience, who I've learned so much from, and especially because I have a kind of petty point. You spoke only briefly about this the other day, but it's been complete media saturation, so I feel it's worth bringing up. And that had to do with the royal wedding. You spoke briefly but beautifully and with extreme kindness about the marriage. And I'm hoping you can maybe help me see this differently, because I have quite a different perspective. I find it difficult to... I find it difficult to celebrate anyone's ascension to an aristocracy, because I feel as though we should have fewer aristocrats, not more. And I feel that the kind of all the positive attention that has been given to that wedding is kind of an implicit acceptance of the superiority of aristocracy. I feel there's kind of a cynical element to it. For example, at the moment that the engagement was announced to the public, or was at least in the process of being announced, or people were speculating about it, suddenly there was a release of the interview between Prince Harry and President Obama. And it felt cynical to me that now we're going to suddenly have to accept, because of his marriage, we're supposed to see Prince Harry now as the authority on interaction between the aristocracy and African Americans. And I don't know, maybe I'm seeing this wrong. Maybe you can help me see this differently. But that's how
I'm listening to you. You have some very astute observations. Continue.
Well, that's all I really have to say. Just that I was very impressed at your kindness and the way that you were able to wish them well. And you know, whereas I tried to avoid even paying attention to this entire thing, but it's almost impossible. There's just everywhere you turn, there's talk about it.
I know. We were all Windsored out. But do you see, in the middle of all of this, what people are actually trying to get at? Did you see anything that suggested they were trying to get at something? They didn't quite say it, but they were trying to get at it.
Well, I've been trying to ignore the media coverage of it. I mean, it seems to me. it seems to me that you know, they're trying to show that the royal family now is accepting of people of different races, and but I feel as though they're using that in a way. I can't take it fully seriously. You know,
you can't deny that it was a historic occasion. Okay,
yes.
For what it was. I mean, this does not mean that you agree with it or you endorse it, but it was a historic moment.
Yes.
And, you know, with a moment such as that, it comes with all the frou-frou, all the ceremony and whatnot. They did all of that.
Mm-hmm.
But what I got was the inkling of a suggestion. It's all really low-key. That in many ways, the aristocracy itself would be slightly different because it marked a moment in time when the old, no matter how much they resisted, and they did that very gracefully, but it also suggested to me that people recognized or were beginning to recognize a shift to the new. What that shift would be, I don't know. But we saw many things that indicated a departure from the norm. Now, I'm more than anybody, I think. I detest the British aristocracy. Most any aristocracy.
Yeah.
Because I was born and raised in it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was not a pleasant experience. It still isn't for me.
No.
But you can see in these two young people that they themselves have a different vision. And they will try. They can't. Look. You cannot easily change Queen Elizabeth II's mind about anything. But I got an inkling that in these two people, there will be some gradual change and recognition of what the aristocracy could do if it chose to do it. It was very symbolic that Prince Harry and his new bride, Miss Markle, the Duchess now, did not go immediately on a honeymoon, but instead devoted the very next day to getting some charitable work done. Now, all things considered, you know, it's not about making a big splash about anything, but it was about making a statement about their consciousness of what they could do in the world to change this equation of the aristocracy and then the rest of us schlubs. You know, in that sense, the small things spoke pretty loudly. And I paid attention to the way they handled themselves. Very different. The Minister Curry, who preached at the wedding, very different message. And if you paid attention to the message, he directly addressed the evils of slavery. Hello, 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 Queen Elizabeth. He talked, you know, so it was very subtle.
Mm-hmm.
These things were very subtly done, but in the way we interpret history, I mean, and the institution, they resonated quite loudly. And I will be pleased to see that the two newlyweds continue on their path of humanitarianism as a reminder that, you know, this is the way the kingdom could have gone if it had a conscience, but it didn't.
Mm-hmm. Well, I hope you're right, and I appreciate what you've said, and I think I'll go back and now and listen to that, the sermon. I didn't pay attention to any of the media coverage of the event, but I'm going to go back now and listen to it on your recommendation. So thank you for that.
Like, I mean, look at it. They made a strong effort to distance themselves, even symbolically, from the grand institution of the monarchy, and to indicate they have some new ideas, and they may be going, you know, a new way, not fast enough or not radically enough, but symbolically enough. So we maintain hope.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Utrecht. I really appreciate your input on that.
Thank you for calling in.
Yes, okay.
Willie from Brooklyn, you're on the air.
My dear beloved sister, how are you?
Okay.
Very interesting.
Could you speak directly into the phone? We're getting a lot of reverb.
Is it okay now?
Lot of background noise, so we're not hearing you clearly. Could you speak directly into the phone?
I am.
You're on speakerphone.
What about now?
Yeah,
is much that better?
Better.
Okay, yes. Good. Oh, I wish I was articulate like you were. I know what I want to say and what's in my mind, but I'm just not articulate like you are.
Just say what you need to say.
Yes, Utrecht. You know what? The thing that's bothering me. What happened in the outside? You know, these people, they really, really have got. They have made it clear who's taking it, because you have told the world that God gave you this land. Now you tell me, what kind of God is that would give you some other people's land, and you bulldoze them and you shoot them and you do all manner of evil to them? What kind of God is that?
Well, you know it's not about.
But anyway,
God. God, if God is so mighty, I think he could speak for himself.
I mean, you know, I mean, if you could make up a story like that on God, we're supposed to be righteous, just, fair, loving, compassionate, and you could
Willie.
Yes.
Has this not been happening all throughout civilization? Where people, in furthering their own crazy plans, invariably invoke God and place themselves as, we are just his servants doing his will. We only have to kill off a bunch of people, but it's God's will. You can't argue, at least they think you can't argue about God. And since they say they're following the commands of God, how do we know that they're not?
Because these are the same people. South Africa, remember? The gold mines in South Africa, one of the most tyrannical and barbaric, savage government in the annals of history? Same people.
Yes, but how do you know that they weren't following God's orders then? You see, the point I'm making is a defense is raised that puts God in charge of all of that evil. God is the reason that there has to be a genocide. God is the reason that they dispossess people of their land. God is the reason that they're doing things so tyrannical. How are we to argue with God? And that's their strong card. The strong card is, if we are arguing with them, we are arguing with God.
But you see, there's a big difference today, Utrecht. Today, we are social media. Today, the media is not controlled by them. You see what I'm saying? And besides all of that, that reality, you get in front of the world and you project and promote this thick, tyrannical idea. This really annoys me. It really, really does.
It is a very annoying thing, but guess what? The reality with which we live. Oh. It is the reality with which we live. And you have to understand that that is a system. The creation of a belief backed up by an action. So the belief is they are simply implementing the directives of God. And God will see them through because what they are the chosen people. God is so crazy that of all the people he created, God is so crazy that he has a special group. So you can't argue with people who are taking this line of reasoning. I once sat across a table from Elie Wiesel, who, as you know, he's now gone. Is deceased. He was recognized as a world symbol of the Jewish Holocaust. This was on Channel 13. And I asked him, do you recognize what has happened in the Atlantic slave trade? And what has happened in the United States, the genocidal acts against the Native Americans, do you recognize this? Would you call these holocausts? And he said, no, these are not holocausts. And I said, why would you say they're not? And he said, I'm not answering that question. So that at the same time that people commit themselves to an ideology, they can't defend it. Only that they raise this up as the argument that you too should not be able to question. It simply is the case. There's no other Holocaust anywhere at any other time in the world. I thought that was a remarkable response from a man who received Nobel prizes and Peace Prize and all kinds of international prizes for his work in dealing with the Holocaust. When you have people who are committed to thinking one way, the founders of the so-called State of Israel, that was the belief. They are going to create a land as commanded by God. How are you going to argue that?
One quick. They wanted Uganda. That was their second choice, Palestine. It was Uganda they wanted. Is that correct?
Well, no. They've wanted several places, including South Africa. Including other parts of the so-called Middle East. But I'm talking about how does a belief system inform a military action and a cultural orientation? That's what has happened. How do you justify just taking people's land, getting them off of their ancestral lands? But we've seen it. We've seen it here in the United States. We've seen it all over the world. People just deciding, well, we're going to live here and you're not. We are entitled to everything that we find here, and you are not. And if you're going to live here, if we permit you to live here in your ancestral lands, you'll have to follow some rules, which we will make.
And live under subhuman condition.
Yeah, they don't care about that. That is immaterial. Because the very word that you use, subhuman, comes along with the thinking that has to be propagated. That the people you conquer are less than. They are animals. This was the whole point there in slavery. When Britain was arguing, or some in Britain were arguing about this question of slavery. And the great, he was a minister. He was a man of God. He wrote a book called The Nigger Question. What do we do with the niggers that we now have control of all over the world? They are beasts of burden, he argued. This is a minister, Sir Thomas Carlyle. And their job, they are put on the earth to be used like beasts of burden. That's what they're there for. Right. So that Britain should have no pangs of conscience about what it was doing in the Caribbean or in Africa. Don't worry about it. God ordained their station in life. And then we had a response by John Stuart Mill. He wrote the counter to that argument called The Negro Question. But it was significant that the most heinous, the most antithetical argument you can get was from a minister. And he gave Britain permission to be at ease with itself over slavery that it had by then introduced all over the hemisphere. So this comes with the territory. People who are unreasonable, people who are fanatical, people who believe strongly, they invent a theory and they believe it with all their heart and soul, and therefore the battle literally is for the mind. Even the slaves themselves were convinced that God did intend for them to be slaves.
Right.
So you could see the viciousness of this kind of thinking, but it's psychological warfare. You know, some people would call it, you know, it's racism. That's a simple term for it. It's a really complex kind of domination and annihilation, ultimately creating millions of people, masses of people engaged in self-annihilation by adopting and thinking very much the same about themselves as the conquerors did about them. Thanks, Willie, for your call today.
Oh, you're Trees.
Yes.
Hello?
Yes.
I know you're going to jump on me because you always say, why every time I talk to you, you speak about Mr. Farrakhan. I know you're going to beat me up on that. But you see, I love the truth because this is one of the reasons why before I even knew you, I came to defend you with my life. Stop me when I lie. Is that true? Every day when they thought,
yes, when we were going through a very rough period at the station in which literally our lives were threatened, there were quite a few people. You were one of them showing up every day.
I was willing to go with you as long as I took somebody, whoever is doing want to do it to you, they're coming with us. That's all. Anyway, that's why I love you so much and respect you so much because you make no apologies in speaking truth. Well, by the way, I know you're not going to like this, but Minister Farrakhan will be speaking this weekend. You just have to go to the Nation of Islam website, and it comes on at 11 o'clock. So I'd like for everybody. Said about
hello?
And it told, hello, I'm here.
Okay.
Hello?
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Willie. Thanks so much. Bruce from New York, you're on the air.
Hello, good afternoon, Yatrice.
Good afternoon, Bruce.
Good afternoon. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm hanging in.
Right, okay. So I just wanted to commend you on the way you deal with this question about the Jews, you know? Without hate, but with truth. Because, I mean, this question worries me all the time. Why? And there are a number of progressives, George Galloway, for instance, you know, who has argued and continues to argue that that the Jewish Holocaust is the greatest crime ever committed by human beings. I mean, and they will not be deterred by the arguments that we would like to make about the African Holocaust, yeah, where at least 100 million people died or were rooted from Africa. Or the Holocaust of the native peoples of this hemisphere, again, about 100 million died, and people just feel comfortable, you know, because of it's politically acceptable for someone like George Galloway, for instance, to make this argument in London, you know, and it bothers me all the time why these white progressives cannot see a bigger picture. I mean, you have a situation where 6 million people died and the Jewish people were compensated. Then you have a situation where other people died, their land, and it's still happening in Palestine today. The same forces that killed the Native Americans or enslaved the African people are doing the same thing based on the same general precepts in Palestine today. And this notion about this is the biggest crime that human beings ever committed against other human beings, I mean, you know, is so false that it bothers me how more people are not calling out these liberals, these white progressives on this issue.
Well, the sad part is it's not just white progressives. It's people who wish to indicate to the power structures that, you know, they're endorsing the deliberate distortion of history. It is estimated, for example, that more than 150 million Africans, and that they can't get the count right. They're saying, we just estimating were taken out of Africa. Somebody's got to account for that. There's, you know, they didn't just wake up one day and decide that they will transport themselves, sever their ties with their families and their cultures, and just transport themselves to a new world. But all throughout the world, there have been Holocausts. All throughout the world. So I don't understand why people, I mean, at some point, we have to create our own narratives, our own history. That's the whole point.
And the people who have suffered are still suffering today. I mean, nobody has said reparations are due. And another thing about this Jewish Holocaust, nobody ever wants to talk about the involvement of American corporations, for instance, in getting cheap labor of Jews in Europe. You know, nobody wants to talk about IBM and all these other corporations that were involved in helping Hitler to make the trains run on time and this kind of thing. And these are respectable institutions today still. Or the people who used to make or uniforms for the SS, for instance, Hugo Boss, for instance, you know. People are buying these people's clothing. And it's all right, you know. But African people, on the other hand, or indigenous people here, could never talk about approaching these issues about reparations or even getting white people generally to accept these things around and stop killing black people in the streets, for instance, which is an extension of the same process that we are talking about right now.
Well, these things, which is why we need a cadre, and this is what every people experiencing this kind of brutality and criminality against them, they have to invest in retrieving the missing pages of their history for themselves. They've got to do it. But we find a reluctance in the sense that our academicians, there are very few who can undertake this exercise and just do that. It is not a very sexy and attractive project, so it doesn't get done by people who can fund these things. But that is the job. The job is to retrieve your missing history as best you can. And we have any number of historians, not nearly enough, but we have quite a few who have done much to educate us and lift us out of the ignorance that we've been subjected to. And right now, the urgent need is to create a living testimonial in the way of creating history. What really happened? Who did what? And let's be brutally honest about it.
Yeah, I mean we have a number of authors, I mean Jewish authors especially, you know, who have studied the involvement of Jews within the slave trade. You know, we know, for instance, that Christopher Columbus himself was an Italian Jew. Yeah, and we know that the Jews built New York based on cotton grown on plantations down south that were that were controlled by Jews. We know in Barbados, for instance, the country which I came from, we have a Jewish synagogue that is second oldest in the Western Hemisphere, only younger than the one in Brazil, for instance, right? So when the Jews came with slaves on their boats, I mean, it was their business. It was the first globalization epoch, right? When they came with slaves on their boat, they used to go into this Jewish synagogue in Barbados and pray while, you know, at the same time selling slaves in a slave market, you know?
But nobody wants to. Let me ask you a very, very simple question. Do you expect people, or a people, who have such a long history of wrongdoing, and that not as a people, because all Jews weren't slaveholders, all Jews didn't subscribe to the theory of Zion, and still today they don't.
Agreed.
You have many, many Jews who absolutely reject Zionism, but you would never hear anything about it.
But at the same time, there's a discourse. You see, I don't know if that discourse, although I currently accept it as a dominant narrative, could be the discourse that I hold on to, because we can't be holding on to discourse that says, well, look, all Jews were not involved in this, and we still have people killing people in Palestine today.
We can't deny the participation of Africans in slavery.
Of course, yeah, of course.
We can't deny that. So the idea is an honest history that reflects all of these realities.
As I told you before, you know, I am starting to favor a discourse that says that there was a war between Europe and Africa, and slavery was a byproduct of it, you know, and not a institution in itself, you know. So I favor
discourse. But there wasn't a war between Europe and Africa. You see, this is the other problem.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't a war between two parties which would suggest that they were mutually engaged in war. No, the African countries were attacked and assailed and methodically destroyed.
Well,
There's no war between them.
Okay.
One group set upon the other. And I'm hearing music, which means our time is up. Thank you so much for contributing so meaningfully. I love Free Your Mind Friday because you come with your best thoughts. Stay tuned. Coming up next, Alternative Visions with Dr. Jack Asmus, and we'll see each other on Monday. Bye-bye.